You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show, rated the number one podcast of all time.
Of all time. Make sure you're ready, because this is the podcast where you are guaranteed to learn virtually everything.
We are with David Grant, and he wrote a book called The Lost City of Z, A Deadly Tale, A Tale of Deadly Obsession in the Amazon. And before we start, let's get down. Oh, by the way, this is the Brian Callen Show. Hunter Motz. I whisper Hunter's name. I don't want him taking. He's such a huge part of the show, but I try to minimize that.
But he's got to beat me back. You know what I mean?
I have to beat you back.
It's kind of like the barbarians in the latter Roman Empire. You know, they keep on encroaching on the borders.
You are correct, sir. You are correct. Very quickly, everybody, because the most important thing is where I'm doing stand-up. I'm so bad at self-promotion. Where am I going to be? You know what? I'll be at Wise Guys in Salt Lake City the 29th and 30th. So if you're Mormon, come on down. Come on down, baby. Right at the day after Thanksgiving, Friday and Saturday, I'm tearing it up. Ladies and gentlemen, give a warm Mormon welcome to Brian the Kid Callen. David Grant, thank you so much for joining our lovely and esteemed podcast. We always try to feature the authors that we kind of catch our eye. Mm-hmm. And you're one of them, obviously. Explain to us for a second here. This book is really, you know, considered nonfiction, but there we really don't know whether this lost city in the Amazon. I mean, first of all, it was made of wood. By the time they came back 50 years later, the place had been, you know, it was no longer. But there is evidence that there was this massive city. And maybe talk a little bit about why you got into, you know, this book is about just as much about obsession and almost like sort of this, like kind of like Ahab chasing the white whale in a way, isn't it?
I mean, it's about, Percy Harrison Fawcett, who was really the last of the kind of great famous Victorian and Edwardian explorers. Mm-hmm. And he had explored the Amazon at the turn of the century when the Amazon really back then remained the last big blank space on the map. Most places had been explored, but the Amazon had not because of the jungle, because of disease. And Fawcett had, in fact, mapped the interior of a lot of the boundaries of South America, a lot of the countries. And during these explorations, he began to gather what he believed was evidence that there was an ancient city, an El Dorado-like city in the middle of the jungle. For example, at one point he was in Bolivia and he found these large earth mounds. And when he looked out, he could swear that connecting the earth mounds were these roads buried under the floor. He also found old fragments of pottery. Now, this was before carbon dating, but mm-hmm. he believed it looked very ancient. Now, of course, most people assumed he was nuts and disproved his theory. And part of the reason they assumed he was nuts was because the general conception of the Amazon was that it was a counterfeit paradise, that despite its kind of seeming luster and animals, that it was really just a deadly space. It was like trying to build a city in the Arctic or something.
Which, in a way, it was. I mean,
yes, it really was. Yeah. I mean, that especially for outsiders, these expeditions would come in and they would just be wiped out by disease. Mm-hmm. Fawcett would take these parties in, and usually half his men would die.
And so
the general conception of the Amazon, because all anyone had seen was it could really only support small kind of atomized tribes, mm-hmm. Hunter gatherers. That barely eked out an existence. And Fawcett believed that that was not the case. And so eventually in 1925, he set out with his oldest son, who kind of worshipped him, and his son's best friend, to prove all his critics wrong and to find this ancient civilization, which he called Z, or I guess Zed in England.
the end of the world. Yeah.
End of the world. And he sent out these dispatches that were actually carried out by these Indian runners. And so I was able to, in the course of my research, literally track his journey. And then mm-hmm. these dispatches eventually just stopped coming. And a year passed and another year passed, and he essentially disappeared. And was never seen from again. And all these expeditions then set out either initially to rescue him and the party and to find out whether this ancient civilization that he called Z existed or not. Mm-hmm. And it had remained this kind of great mystery and debate for more than a century. And I should also add that most of these parties that went in search of him or in search of Z, they also either they ended in disaster. They either disappeared or they were wiped out and killed either by tribes or by disease or by starvation.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the one thing I know, I spent some time in the Indonesian rainforest, and there here are a couple things to know. If you want to eat, you better get used to bugs. And by the way, there are bugs everywhere.
Yeah,
good luck catching snakes. Good luck catching forest grouses. Good luck catching anything. Most of the life happens 100 feet above your head.
That's mm-hmm. exactly right.
And the bugs are, people don't realize, we had to carry a sulfur coil. The mosquitoes and the bugs laugh at your off and your mosquito repellent. They laugh at it. Okay, so I can't imagine. Not to mention the fact that when these guys would go in there and I want to talk a little bit about how fearless the Victorian, the British were. Just how fearless they were. Shackleton. There was this notion of, I mean, talk about grit.
Stiff upper lip.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of in a way what influenced the entire world. The notion of the great chain of being. Institution, your duty as a man, all these things that really were very, very resilient and sort of the cornerstone of British culture when you think about it back then.
Yeah, and Fawcett had really grown up, you know, he was, you know, really an embodiment of that. He mm-hmm. had grown up in the Victorian era. He had grown up kind of worshiping the Victorian explorers, especially the ones who had explored in Africa, Livingston, Stanley, etc., and these were kind of his icons, and he began to really model himself after them. What was interesting to me when I found out, and usually when you begin these research projects, you don't know what you will find. And one of the things that kind of interested me was, and it gets a little bit to this grid as well, was that Fawcett was a member of the Royal Geographical Society, which ended up sponsoring his expedition, as it sponsored many of the old Victorian expeditions. And, you know, he almost essentially always kind of went to explorer school, although it was incredibly primitive. He was basically given these books, and I was able to find copies of the books he was given, and they would describe, you know, what you were supposed to do and how you were supposed to explore and what you were supposed to document, and he went through all these kind of rituals. But it was kind of amazing because, you know, this was still, even though it was early 20th century, it was really still pre-modern when it came to expeditions. Mm-hmm. And so, for example, his books would tell him, you know, if he was bit by a poisonous snake, to take gunpowder, pack it into the wound, and explode it.
Oh my God!
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask you, because my buddy just went to the Amazon, in fact, and he wrote a book about getting ready for the apocalypse. So he wanted to live sort of, you know, with some of the native tribes and live off the land essentially without technology. By the way, they needed a lot of technology, and he lost 13 pounds. Froze. Yeah. They caught a first of all, he froze and because of the rain. Oh, and by the way, he was always hungry, and then he got a fever that they couldn't explain. And this is in 2013, mm-hmm. and they finally caught a chicken because yeah, this guy set a trap, and they ate that chicken like it was, you know, like they'd found the Holy Grail, and he got a couple of mouthfuls, you know. This wasn't chicken tenders, man.
Yeah. And you know, when you were talking a little bit earlier about the mosquitoes is interesting too, because, you know, most people's conception of the Amazon is, you know, they think of like old bad B movies. They think, oh, the piranha's going to get you, or the, mm-hmm. you know, the giant snake. And there's certainly a lot of poisonous things.
The jaguar, yeah.
Yeah, that somehow these are going to kill you. And the truth is that the most deadly thing in the Amazon, especially back then, because it was pre-immunities, mm-hmm. was the invisible bugs. I mean, mm-hmm. they all
malaria,
yellow fever,
dysentery,
bone crusher fevers I've never even heard of.
What's bone?
I don't even know, but that's what they called it back then.
Oh my God.
It just sounded bad.
Does it ever? I've never heard. That's hilarious. I got a bone crushing fever. I'm using that.
It's amazing.
Yeah, and Fawcett would just basically, I mean, you know, he had this kind of counterintuitive theory that the only way to survive was to take small parties in, because they would impose a threat to the Native Americans. It would be easier to live off the land. Mm-hmm. Most people would take in these huge parties, sometimes 100 people, even more.
Well, like Teddy Roosevelt's party when, you know, Teddy Roosevelt went down there and, you know, he totally underestimated the Amazon and nearly died.
But he was also, Teddy Roosevelt, I guarantee, was on the outskirts and like kind of dipped a toe.
Absolutely.
He was really good at creating a myth around himself, from what I've read.
Well, he had a big party and he benefited. He had a, he had a guide who was, you know, a great Amazon and Brazilian explorer, a guy named Rondon. So now what they did is they stuck to the waterways and Fawcett, because of what he was looking for, crossed the land. And it just the magnitude of danger is just exponential, as you can imagine. One, you can flee easier on water. You can travel faster. There are less threats of animals. Fawcett would just cut straight through the jungle on foot.
Well, what a badass. What a
badass.
Yeah. I mean, I just – have you ever trekked through the Amazon, David?
I did, yeah.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
This
yeah.
guy's not just a writer, ladies and gentlemen. He probably had a bandana on.
Yeah.
And, yeah, I mean,
no, basically, I always say it was like Woody Allen in the jungle, is my name.
Oh, that's so. Wait, I just need a cappuccino or something. This is outrageous.
Yeah, no, I did. I tried to follow. I followed as close to Fawcett's trail as I could, and you know, gather clues, and it really helped me to write the book. It really helped me to write the book because, you know, one of the things again, you kind of roll the dice with these things, and you don't always know what you're going to find. And certainly heading out into the jungle on my part was probably the more foolhardy and foolish thing I'd done. But, you know, one of the things I encountered on my trip, I met a tribe that had a oral history about Fawcett.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
It was basically this legend. And they were really the last people to see Fawcett alive. And this oral history, which had been passed down for generations, really had clues to what happened to Fawcett.
Right. Hmm. I like to feign, like, what, you know, tell us more. They create, like, more. People should read this book, though. This is so cliche, but, you know, Hunter and I were talking about, it is a page turner.
Oh, it's amazing. Yeah.
It's a page turner.
And it just, I mean, you know, in terms of, that badassery, it's, you know, people think they're tough.
Yeah, good luck.
Yeah, good luck in the Amazon.
My buddy was a Green Beret, and he did his training down in the Amazon. And he's as tough as it gets. And he said to me, his foot stayed wet for 6 months. He said at one point he took his boot off and he pulled his heel off. The skin had become so waterlogged that basically the skin died and his whole heel basically came off. Good stuff.
You know, one of the expeditions that Fawcett went on before he disappeared, he took with him a guy named Murray, who had been a very famous...
The tennis player, no.
Yeah, you know, tennis player. A very famous, then famous Arctic explorer.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually he, in fact, died and disappeared in the Arctic later on. But, you know, he had survived. He had gone, actually, on an earlier trip with Shackleton, on Shackleton's first trip. And, you know, he really believed that he was a badass. And, and he thought, having survived what he did in the cold... he would be fine in the Amazon.
Your tendency because when you're freezing in the Arctic, what they forget about the Arctic is because it's so cold, you're not dealing with diseases and bugs and things, right?
Yeah, you are dealing with frostbite and gangrene. I mean, I went to an all-boys boarding school in Britain, and, you know, there was still a little bit of that sort of stiff upper lip thing that was there. And they would tell us all these stories about Lawrence Oates from the Shackleton expedition, who got such bad frostbite and gangrene, like his foot is rotting off, and he realizes that he's slowing down the expedition and they're probably not going to make it out if he stays. And so he says, famously, he says, "I'm going for a walk. And I may be some time," and he wanders off into the snow to die.
God,
the difference in many ways, the Arctic and those explorers, which are equally just incredibly arduous, but there's almost a nothingness. I mean, what they confront is almost a nothingness, a cold, an emptiness, an incredible tedium. You know, the ice can open up, and it's the cold, but it's But in the Amazon, the difference is basically a constant assault of the senses. In the Arctic, your senses basically get shut down because of the cold.
Oh, wow.
And, and in the Amazon, you're essentially an assault. And so when Fawcett went with Murray, they both had these titanic egos, as a lot of these folks did. And Fawcett, you know, thought he was better, and Murray thought he was better. And they basically clashed in the jungle. But I was able to find Murray's diary. And, you know, it is from that trip. And it is one of the most harrowing things I've ever read.
Really?
It just describes him slowly losing his mind from the bugs eating him, from starvation. And he eventually begins to get these, forgetting what they're called now, but they're basically, he gets worms that go inside his body.
That's a good time.
And they're about 2 inches long.
Yeah, the New Guinea worms. That's a great time.
And they're alive, and then you can pull them out. And he got his whole body's getting taken over these worms, and he's basically losing his mind. And he hears Fawcett on the other party. Fawcett had a rule that, you know, if you became too sick, they would have to abandon you because they couldn't carry you out. That you would, and they basically essentially sign a contract agreeing to this, that you will be discarded or abandoned to die if you're too sick or wounded to carry on. And so, you know, he starts, you know, he hears them talking about abandoning him, and he's basically losing his mind, and he has these worms in his body. And it was after I finished writing the book and I got on my journey and everything, I had a fact checker who, you know, just to make sure I got things right and check details and animals, make sure my descriptions were accurate. And she came to me one day and she said, "Well, I got to show you something." And she comes to my computer and says, "I want to show you something on YouTube." And she found there's a video of these worms being pulled out of someone. And I'll just tell you this, had I seen that before, I never would have gone on my trip.
Wow. Well, you know, when I was in Indonesia, you could not stop from getting what they called these heat-seeking leeches. They were ground leeches. And what you do is you literally take your socks off and you take your shirt off. And on your neck and on your heels and your calves, you'd have, oh, I don't know, 7-8 these thick black leeches. And the reason that I never worried about them is because they actually don't carry any communicable diseases, but just be sucking your blood. My sister was tying her jeans down and putting turpentine on her legs and her neck.
Woman.
Yeah. And I just kind of said, you know what, I'm just going to give into this. And I would come back and my sister would flip out. I would be covered in leeches.
Ugh.
And you just pull them off and it wasn't. But now worms.
That are inside your body.
Now that's a neck. That's Amazon shit, right? That's like, that's yeah, as they say on the street, that's next level shit.
Yeah. I mean, basically, as I remember, yeah, it's been a while, but as I remember, they get deposited. They're like from some kind of a bug, basically deposits their little eggs on your skin, and then the worms burrow down, and then they hatch inside you, and they grow.
That's
so
a good
just,
time.
You know, all right, enough with that.
No. I love it. Now, tell us a little bit about there is also a fish that swims into your penis.
Candiru.
And then then barbs out, and so you can't really get it out of your
penis, and so you have to chop it off.
I use the word cock because I don't like penis sounds small and broken, but keep going.
Fawcett had seen people die from that because it basically blocks your urethra.
I mean, it's like, hey, God made a place that just sucks. So it's literally one of Dante's rings.
Yeah.
Am I right?
But the amazing thing is, and Fawcett really turns out to be prescient, which is that, you know, there's human ingenuity is kind of a marvelous thing. And a lot of these native populations have kind of found really ingenious ways to transcend their environment to raise agriculture to support large populations or larger populations than were previously believed, and that's kind of part of the book is testing that theory, and so it's an adventure tale, but it's also, if Fawcett was right, it would really transform our understanding of early human history, the ability of cultures to transcend geography, and so that's partly what the book and part of the journey is about.
Well, you know, Jared Diamond would disagree with you, probably. I mean,
he would, yes.
and
he probably would, although he has some caveats. Yeah, yeah.
You know, he does. The only issue would be that in the Amazon, because it's such an inhospitable place, because edible grasses like barley and wheat and things are hard to sustain. They don't really grow in that environment. You'd have a tough time even with all the rain cultivating rice or yams and things.
Well, but it also depends on the population densities that we're talking about, right?
Right.
I mean, human beings can also live in the Arctic, right? Are you going to
yep.
be able to support a great civilization
up there? But
they're hunter-gatherers. Yeah,
they're,
exactly.
As was the bulk of the Amazon. So the argument
right.
against the lost city of Z may very well be, well, yes, they may have created a city, but then just couldn't sustain it, right,
yeah.
David? I mean,
yeah, I mean, what's interesting is when you read the old first El Dorado expedition, they all describe, you know, right after, you know, they all described the first people kind of went in, the first Europeans to go into the Amazon hunting for El Dorado, all describe actually seeing large, massive populations mm-hmm. along the river's banks, bridges, complex towns, and then later people who came into the Amazon didn't see any of those things, and so they always assumed that these tales were fabrications, and they certainly were filled with fabrications, but they assumed the whole things were fabrications written to kind of impress the kings and their sponsors because they never found all the gold they had promised.
Right.
So that was always the assumption. But Fawcett actually looked at a lot of these early chronicles, and he assumed that they actually had clues to ancient settlements. And what he assumed, and what scientists, a growing number of scientists now believe, is that, in fact, there really were larger populations, and that European disease was actually the culprit, not
right.
so much the environment, that basically European disease wiped out an enormous, I mean, the same thing in the United States, wiped out an enormous amount of people, far larger than anyone previously
well,
thought.
Well, David Grand said the same thing in his
Charles
book.
Mann.
I mean, sorry, Charles Mann, David Grand.
Yeah.
Charles Mann said the same thing in 1491, 1493. We had him on the podcast,
yeah.
and that's exactly right. I mean,
yeah. And to prove this, I mean, they have evidence. It's not just theories. I mean, for example, there's something called Black Earth, and Charles may have talked about this, but, you know, Black Earth is essentially an earth that is enriched through human habitation.
Mm-hmm.
So Black Earth exists if you have a settlement and you throw your garbage inevitably and any of your waste product, and it enriches the earth and it turns it black. Black Earth is evidence of human habitation. Well, in a lot of these places all along where the early conquistadors had described populations, they've now found enormous amounts of Black Earth, which is signs that these places were in fact habited.
Right.
And one of the things that's even more interesting about the Black Earth is, and what the tribes even to this day know, is, you know, the idea that you can't grow crops in the Amazon isn't necessarily true, that you can use Black Earth, which is enriched soil, to have agricultural plant things and grow and have a food help build your food supply. And so And the tribes did this, and they still do this today. They still do this in the very place where Fawcett disappeared, and
mm-hmm.
where they've now found evidence that there were, you know, evidence of moats and things like that where Fawcett believes he would exist. And one of the theories, and this is not yet proven, but the question is, did the tribes actually even create Black Earth purposefully?
Hmm.
They obviously understood its byproduct, that you could use it, but did they, by using burning and other techniques, charcoal to enrich the soil, actually create their own Black Earth? And that's still a topic that's debated. But the point is, the Black Earth both A, shows there were populations, and B, indicates how they were able to help sustain themselves.
And it's fairly clear that there was some sort of large civilization in the Amazon. I mean, at the end of the book, you talk about finding post holes and massive road systems and, you know,
bridges.
So
you could see ramp going up one side of the river and then a ramp going down on the other. The massive ancient moats and all these things have been carbon dated. And there's just these discoveries have been, there's been kind of a slew of them. And so in various parts of the Amazon, I mean, these
mm-hmm.
massive kind of geographical, landscapes they're now finding are man-made.
But the thing is, how did these tribes, and it's a thing, how do you think that they cut down these massive trees these old growth trees without metal tools. You know, that seems like it would take forever with a stone axe or something. Mm-hmm. Is there any talk and theory on that?
You know, that's a good question, and to be honest, I don't know the answer. And now, when I get off, I'm going to find out the answer. Well, one of my anthropologist friends. You know, I don't know the answer to that. I don't know. I mean, part of the things they would often use, there are places where a lot of they would build where there wasn't as much trees, but clearly they did also have things where there were trees.
Mm-hmm. Right. Not everywhere has some. You know,
not
like
everywhere.
Like
no,
every topography.
Yeah. Exactly. I mean, it's such a vast area. I mean, you know, it's basically the size of the United States, and they would find here, and they would find that.
Is it
example,
the size? Is it the size of the
yeah,
U.S.?
Brazil
it's not
is
the size of the United yeah. States.
That's unbelievable to me. So the continental United States could fit in where the Amazon is.
Yeah, it's about the same.
Are
size.
You kidding? I didn't know that. Yeah. That's astounding to me.
Yeah.
Brazil is about the same size as the United States. I think minus Alaska, and most of Brazil is the Amazon.
I did not know that. I guess that's why they call Brazil the lungs of the world. these are the kinds of things you learn
on
the Brian
Callen
Show.
Brian
Callen, Hunter Mont.
No, the Brian Callen Show. Let's not encroach.
Literally, David, since Hunter's...
By the end, I'm going to be throwing my name out there.
Well, yeah, exactly. The Brian Callen, Hunter Mont, David
Grant.
Easy. You're welcome to. I mean, what's funny is that Hunter, before Hunter came along, I was basically interviewing comics and actors, and what a bore. And then Hunter came along and said, you know, there are a lot of really smart people who write books, and you know when you read the books, I'm sure they'd be willing to talk to you about it. And it's been such a joy to talk to guys like you who spend their time. And here's my question: When was the moment you decided I have to write a book about this lost city?
You know, I came across that story when I was doing research for a story I did in the New Yorker, which is part of the title of the other book, the Sherlock Holmes. A Devil in Sherlock Holmes, and I was doing research on a piece about the world's greatest Sherlock Holmes scholar and Conan Doyle scholar who had been found mysteriously garroted in his apartment.
Yeah.
And all these Sherlockians took up the case as if it were the most, you know, interesting and important case and more tangled than anything of fiction. And in the course of that research, I read everything I could about Conan Doyle, and
he was an amazing guy, wasn't he?
I mean, yeah, and I learned that Percy Harrison Fawcett, the man who searched for the City of Z, had been partly the inspiration for one of the characters in The Lost World, and so I started to just that's where I got the bug, and then I began to read about him, and then I kind of called up. I went and did something you often do, which is, you know, I went into old historical newspaper databases, and I started to see these just incredibly, like, the most intriguing, bizarre, fascinating headlines, like, movie star searches for Fawcett, movie star vanishes in jungle, because he was somebody who had actually searched for Fawcett. You know, Fawcett's party, you know, now gone for 3 months, where are they? And these were banner headlines, and what's amazing about history is just how much is forgotten. So these were headlines in the New York Times, the Washington Post. I mean, he was in his day, you know, it's like saying, you know, where's Hoffa buried in the United States? If you said, you know, where's Fawcett buried, anyone in any continent knew that
really?
Question.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Oh, man.
And so I was like, so who is this guy that we have forgotten in this lost history? And then eventually I started to do research on him. And then eventually I went to England and I tracked down Fawcett's granddaughter and a lovely woman. And she took me in her house. I told her about my interest in Fawcett. And eventually she said, you know, do you really want to know what happened to Fawcett? I said, sure, you know, of course. And she led me into this back room. And I described this in the book. She had this old chest, wooden chest. It was covered with dust. She opened up the chest. Inside this chest were these old books. They were grimy. They had little ribbons kind of falling apart on them, the pages half falling out. Some had locks on them. And I said, well, what are those? And she said, well, those are Fawcett's secret diaries and logbooks.
Yeah.
And I began to cull those for details. And that was really when I said, you know, this is
a book.
This is a book, a hell of a story.
And, mm-hmm.
And did you read, how many of those did you read?
I look through all of them. I mean,
I love journalists, by the way. I love you guys. You guys, first of all, a huge part. I mean, when you write for The New Yorker, I should just tell people, because a lot of people don't really necessarily read that magazine. You got to be top. That's all-star stuff. I mean, that's the best. Some of the best writing. I don't care. And has been for the past, I don't know, 80 years or since its inception. You can't be a lightweight and write for The New Yorker. But when I talk to guys like you, it's obvious that the amount of research you do and knowing how to do that research, you know, when you read his diaries, were they written in the English that you and I speak, or were they written in sort of a different?
Well, it was interesting. There was a couple things. One is his writing was so small. He wrote so small. I mean, it was the tiniest handscript I'd ever seen. So,
which makes sense.
It was painstaking to look at. The English, he was a very literate man, and his writing and style were wonderfully lucid and easy to understand. But his you know, these things have been washed through who knows what. You know, he'd carry these books through the jungle with him. And
so they
were hard to read. And occasionally there would be a little bit of code because he was very secretive about his discovery, and he wanted to be the first to get there. And so occasionally he would use codes. I found a letter, in fact, that he had sent to his wife where he includes a cipher for her to understand when he's describing things in code.
Wow. What animals did he see that you don't talk about? Were there things that...
He saw them all. I mean, he talks about, I'm trying to think. I mean...
Monkeys and...
Monkeys.
Any jaguars?
Howler monkeys, piranha... and why am I blanking the name of the big snake right now? Help me.
The reticulated python or...
No, boa constrictor.
Anaconda.
Anaconda, yes. Yeah. So he describes...
That's anaconda. How they describe my arms, but keep going.
Yes,
and something else.
Yeah, my nickname, yeah.
Yes, and he described, obviously, somewhat incessantly, although not as incessant as partner of the bugs and stuff.
I think the whole idea of the counterfeit paradise, which is really something that is tested throughout the book, right? Mm-hmm. Is this a counterfeit paradise or not? But, you know, you really give some really good examples in the book of the ingenuity of the Indians to be able to take advantage of all of the different plants in the rainforest. The one that I really loved is where they take that plant and they use it to stun the fish so that even have to fish the fish. You can just pull them out of the water.
Yes, remarkable. Yeah, it's basically like an anesthetic they found, and they would put it in the water, and it would stun the fish, and then they would just basically shoot with their arrows. And it's like, you know, it is quite literally shooting fish in a barrel. I mean, they just lay, and the amazing thing about it is the fish get stunned, and then they float, and they lay there. If you then leave them, they will eventually come back alive. It doesn't actually kill them.
Mm-hmm.
It just stuns them out of motion.
Wow.
And they use that same thing often for anesthesia for, you know, when they had toothaches and things like that as well.
Mm-hmm.
I always have these fantasies when I read books like yours where I'm in the forest with a bunch of very hot women because our Sports Illustrated swimsuit plane went down, and now I know how to stun fish. I'm like, you girls want some sushi or what? You know, I'm sorry, David. Sorry to bring it down to that level.
You're blushing. Yes.
I apologize. I know you're. Okay. I know you're a respected journalist author, and here I am talking about Sports Illustrated girls. This is what happens when you stoop to our level, sir. I mean, David Grand sounds like it should have "Sir" in front of it. I don't know why. Ladies and gentlemen, it's the Brian Callen, Hunter Montana, and Sir David Grand show.
KBE. So and then your latest book is The Devil in Sherlock Holmes.
That's right.
Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, The Devil in Sherlock Holmes is a collection of my stories, and it actually includes a story which I described that had actually led to my book on The Lost City of Z about the world's greatest Sherlock Holmes scholar. And it's basically stories that involve intrigue, like The Lost City of Z, involve elements of mystery.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the stories are mysteries to some degree. And kind of the theme that in some ways unites the stories, and I could talk a little bit more specifically about some of the different mysteries, but is that the characters involved I refer to them as the Watsons of the world, as opposed to the Sherlock Holmes of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And by that I mean is they can see, but they don't necessarily observe. That they can't always. They miss things. They're human. I mean, Sherlock Holmes was this kind of Superman of reason. He really, to me, you know, he was a superhero. He was infallible. He could deduce the smallest clues.
He would just sit there and smoke his pipe and come up with an answer.
But they're fairy tales. I mean, that's partly why people love them. I mean, the world is always reordered. The chaos is always reordered. We have intellectual puzzles of murder. We always know who did it in the end, for the most part.
Mm-hmm.
And in real life, it's not that way. And so the people, and which is what I think actually makes life more interesting, which is the people I describe, including Fawcett, who was incredibly observant and had many Sherlockian skills, but he's still Watson. He has foibles. He has blinders.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's what I love about the book and the way you write. It's actually more. It's less a mystery about, you know. It's more a question of why and what was driving these people, the guy like Percy Fawcett. It's actually more of a character study. Yeah. That's what I find interesting, and that's what I think people find interesting about this. And your book's been optioned.
Yes.
And which makes total sense, because it's actually a character study on what is driving this person. Why is he this way? That's what I find fascinating, you know?
Well, you know, it's funny. I when I worked on the book, and I'm glad you said that, because when I worked on the book, I had Fawcett's quest, and then I began to think about my own quest, and my quest was a biographical quest. I mean, you're exactly right. That is it. And they both have elements of obsession, and they both have elements of unknowability. And what always strikes me in stories is in anything I write about, and it's true in The Devil and Sherlock Holmes, is, you know, I try desperately to unravel these mysteries and understand the stories the same way the characters do. And there's things you get really close, but you don't know everything. I mean, I have theories about what happened to Fawcett that I think are really pretty good. And I think, you know, circumstantial evidence supports them, I think, pretty strongly. But, you know, I didn't have a recorder there. I didn't have a camera there. Mm-hmm. I don't have his bones. So there's always, you come up against these elements of unknowability. And how humans deal with that unknowability, I find very interesting. And in some cases, it can lead to madness. I mean, Fawcett, by the end of his quest, had pretty much driven himself virtually mad.
Mm-hmm. You know, writers, by the way, that's a helicopter ahead, up above, if anybody can hear. We're being circled, probably looking for me. It's a paparazzi. But apparently we found where the Brian Callen, Hunter Moth, Sir David Grand's podcast is, L.A., but, you know, they always say, and I think this is true for me for sure, is that writers always seem to write about the same thing over and over again in a way. And it's a reflection of what drives them and stuff. To an extent, you write about obsession a little bit. What about you, David? Have you examined that? I mean, obviously you probably have, but what do you think it is about? What are you working out in these books?
That's a good question. I think we need all of Vienna to solve that.
No, I love that. I like that. I get that reference.
No, there. By the way, is a real Woody Allen film. You know, Woody Allen wandering through the Amazon with Sigmund Freud and Carl Jung,
and starring Sir David Gran as Woody Allen.
Yeah.
But you know, I think there are some elements like, you know. I live a pretty mundane, boring existence, and I think I get caught up in these stories, and to some extent there is a thrill that is vicarious where I do things in these stories and pursue things in these stories that I never would otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm also always been kind of obsessed with stories and kind of knowing things, and I think for me that often drives me is to figure out the stories. And, you know, in some ways, my Z is the perfect story, and the truth is, you never find it.
Right,
you can't. You just don't. Yeah. But you're constantly setting out, and you're kind of, and your engine gets revved up again. And usually, it starts slowly. It doesn't start right away, because these things take a lot out of you. I mean, you know, Z took me years, and journey through the Amazon, and being away from my family and my son, who only basically would address the phone. I had a sat phone, and he would address the phone as daddy. You know. And
oh,
so,
man.
Wow.
Yeah. How long were you in the Amazon?
2 months.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's a long time.
And, you know, I had a little kid at the time. So,
it's a long time.
It's a long time. Yeah.
Well, that's the nice thing about, you know, searching for the perfect story as opposed to searching for the City of Z is you don't have worms crawling through your flesh.
It is true. I really, my searches are best when they're done in the library.
Yeah, exactly.
You can have that cup of
espresso.
What surprised you about the Amazon that you weren't ready for?
What surprised me about the Amazon that I wasn't ready for? That's a good question. To some degree, was to an untrained eye, how much you miss and how much similar things look. And yet when you're with someone with a trained eye, they see everything. They see different plant, they see different tree, they see different bug. And yet when you're just trudging through it, I was just always kind of struck like, this looks the same, this looks the same. The other thing is there was a moment in my trip where I got separated from my guide, and I got a glimpse of how disorienting it is because of that. I mean, you know, you really, your sense of direction, I mean, it's a little like a whiteout almost.
Yeah, that's
you,
right.
Your sense of direction, like you think you're so smart and like, okay, I know where I'm going, I'm following now, you kind of look at this guy. And, you know, at least for someone like me, I mean, Fawcett would have figured it out. But I was totally bewildered and totally terrified.
So you are a lot like the Sports Illustrated model in Brian's fantasy.
That's right. David, throw that bikini on and follow me. Get on my back. Did you grow up in New York?
I was born in New York. I grew up in Connecticut.
Oh, okay.
So do you have any particular favorite stories from The Devil and Sherlock Holmes?
You know, there are a few. I mean, the story about the world's greatest Sherlock Holmes scholar is just kind of an incredible mystery, because obviously you had the fact that he was obsessed with Sherlock Holmes and obsessed with mysteries all his life, and then is caught up, is found garroted, and he warns that he fears he's going to be murdered. And I met up with all these Sherlockians, all these other scholars who took up the case, and they were these incredible characters.
Yeah.
And so untangling that mystery, because it also let me explore the literature of Sherlock Holmes and where our fascination comes with, and why Sherlock Holmes seems almost like a living being to us. There's another story in the collection about a legendary French imposter.
So uncomfortable. Yeah.
Yeah, who was known as the Chameleon, and he was a damaged child, broken family, kind of grew up in and out of homes, and he began to become an imposter throughout Europe, where he would always impersonate being a child, and he would be taken into homes and foster homes or institutions, and he did this. He continued to do this even into his 20s, and even when he was balding. And, there was no evidence that he was a pedophile or that he didn't steal. He obviously got resources because they would take care of him, but it seemed to be some kind of, emotional need he was after. And then at a certain point, the authorities are finally catching up with him, and he'd done this all over Europe, and he could just transform his body. He spoke pretty much every European language, where he could learn it very quickly. But they were catching up with him in Spain. And so for the first time, and he always invented identities, and for the first time he stole an identity. And he stole the identity of a missing boy in Texas who had disappeared when he was about 13 years old from San Antonio, Texas. And he impersonates this boy, and then the family comes over, and they bring him back to his... They say they believe he is their missing brother, missing son. And they bring him back, and so this French kid comes and lives in Texas with this Texan family, purportedly as their missing child. And at a certain point, the Chameleon begins to wonder whether he's the one being conned. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of these stories that I try to do and look at are often, you think the ground is settled, and then the ground begins to give way in unexpected ways. And so suddenly you have, in that case, a con man and an imposter who suddenly thrust in the role of becoming an investigator. And he is, by his own admission, a pathological liar. And so the question then becomes, what is real and what is not?
Mm. Oh, I love it.
Yeah, I wish it's amazing stuff.
I know. I'm going to start writing.
And then one other one that another kind of very unusual mystery was It was about a Polish postmodern novelist. He wrote a novel, a very dark postmodern novel, where he plays with the truth and has all sorts of writerly games within the novel, playing with the truth and what is real. And his at a certain point, a man is found dead in Poland, and a detective begins to investigate the case, and it's a dead end. And then he eventually has a clue, and that eventually then leads him to this novel. And as he begins to read the novel, he begins to believe there are actual clues to a real murder in it. And so this detective, who didn't have a college education, if I remember correctly, you know, had to become a postmodernist. And so he begins to try to decode this novel and solve this case.
Wow. Well, let me ask you this. I spent a great deal of my day wishing I were anybody else. I want to be a pro fighter. I want to be a pro tennis player. There's so many things I want to do. Usually I have very long, thick, black Mediterranean hair, and I'm taller, very broad shoulders. It just goes on and on. I'm wearing leather. I might get away with it. It's crazy. And as a writer, I mean, you know, you do in a way write about, if you weren't a writer and as good a writer as you are, and you're a hell of a writer, what do you think you would have, what is the other profession you think you would have chosen? Would it have been maybe a detective?
You know, I think I probably would have loved to have been a detective, to be honest. Yeah. I mean, I was
going
to make
a, in a way.
I was going to make a joking answer and say Ricky Henderson, but but second to that, I think on a more serious level, I would have loved to have been a detective, and I would have loved to have had subpoena power.
Yeah, man, I hear you on that. There are a lot of people I'd like to subpoena. I mean, God,
you know what I could find out from wiretaps. I mean, it would really make
exactly. I mean, the big ear, the NSA is now Sir David Grant. My friend, thank you for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
This
thank
is
you
great.
Guys. All right.
When I'm in New York doing stand up, I'm gonna. Oh, you're in Connecticut.
No, but I go into the city. I work out of the city.
Come down to a show. What do you got to lose? I'll make you laugh for an hour and a half, and then I'll buy you a beer, for God's sake.
You got it. All you
right,
got
pal.
It.
Keep doing what you're doing. It's just fantastic.
Two awesome books, and we're really excited about the third that you'll have to come back on the show and talk about.
Yeah, Lost City of Z, A Tale of Deadly Obsession in the Amazon, and the Devil and Sherlock Holmes, Tales of Murder, Madness, and Obsession. And we're going to put these on the website and promote them and... thank you so much.
Thank you, guys. I appreciate it. Okay.
It.
Take care.
Bye.
Bye.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Another great interview, ladies and gentlemen. David Gran. How about the Amazon, huh? How about fish that swim in your
places
dick?
Exactly. The
candiru. And worms that crawl into your skin. What a great time.
Brian, which would you...
Hey, where's the Four Seasons around here? Fucking kidding me?
Well, which do you think is worse? Do you think worms that crawl in your skin or the vampire fish dick?
There's no question that the vampire, I'll take worms in
my
skin because I can cut them out.
Yeah.
I don't feel like taking a fucking knife to my urethra. When I was in college, yeah. There was something going on with my willy, and the guy stuck a swab down there to see if I had gonorrhea. That sucked worse than anything in the world.
Well,
didn't have gonorrhea.
Yeah.
That's a lie. I don't remember. It was a long time ago. I was a kid. Anyway.
All you know is it wasn't a vampire fish that he stuck up your urethra.
Right. Felt like it, and that's not a barbed fish.
Yeah.
What a shithead animal that is. I would finance, if I had the money, if I had $2 billion, my first order of business was go kill all those dick fish in the Amazon, and I don't care what the ripple effect is. No pun intended.
Well, don't you feel like Bill and Melinda Gates? This whole malaria thing. Like, where
malaria.
Are their priorities?
Get rid of the dick
fish.
That's what I learned.
There's a Kickstarter campaign I can get behind.
Get rid of the dick fish. The candiru. The
worst thing ever.
Whatever.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks for wasting a perfectly good 45 minutes, ladies and gentlemen. I hope you learned something.
Yeah, you learned don't go to the fucking Amazon.
Yes, and come to my stand-up in November. I'm going to be in Salt Lake City on the 29th and 30th, I guess, right after Black Friday. And it's Wise Guys, Salt Lake City. All right, later.
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show. Be sure to visit briancallen.com for information about this episode as well as past and future episodes. You can follow Brian on Twitter at Brian Callen and like him on Facebook. Go to facebook.com/Brian Callen Comedy. Thanks again for listening. We'll see you next time.